Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Sarah Vowell, whose latest book is Unfamiliar Fishes. There are six books in all. The four most recent are books about history from a particular prism, and the first two are essay collections. Sarah Vowell was a contributing editor for This American Life on NPR from 1996 to 2008. She's been a columnist and the voice of Violet on The Incredibles and has done some acting. Sarah Vowell, your last book, The Wordy Shipmates, was about Puritans, and this book is also about Puritans. There is a connection, but the connection isn't Puritans. It's America, somehow, I guess.
Yeah, well, the book about Hawaii in the 19th century is kind of about Americans in Hawaii, and much of that story involves the missionaries who sailed from Boston Harbor in 1819, and they are the literal and spiritual descendants of the original New England Puritans, so there's that connection. I guess that makes it a sequel of sorts.
You talked in an interview that what brought you to Hawaii, obviously beyond just going to Hawaii, was that you were beginning to become obsessed with the Spanish-American War. Was that going to be the book until you got into Hawaii?
No. I had written a book about presidential assassinations, and one of the chapters is on the assassination of President McKinley. And so I had spent some time researching him and his era and that war. And I happened to be working on that book in 2003 as we were getting into Iraq. And, you know, studying up on the Spanish-American War, this preemptive war with, you know, the goal of regime change in Cuba and other Spanish colonies. And there were some parallels there. But I never intended to write a whole book on the Spanish-American War. It just so happened that while I was researching that book, I was in California and I had a few days to kill, and I had always wanted to see Pearl Harbor, so I went to Honolulu for the first time. I went to the Arizona Memorial one morning, and then I still had some time to kill in the afternoon, so then I took the tour of Iolani Palace, and this was in the Victoria Mansion in downtown Honolulu where the old Hawaiian monarchs lived, the last couple anyway. You know, I was taking the tour, and they show you the room where the sons and grandsons of missionaries who overthrew the queen imprisoned her later on when her supporters kind of tried to organize a counter-revolution that didn't really work. So she was locked up in her former palace for treason. They take you into the room where she was held prisoner. It just so happened to be December of 2003, so it was, you know, a week or two after we captured Saddam Hussein, and he was in his prison in a U.S. military compound, and I was standing in her prison cell, and the guide started talking about the overthrow of the monarchy and the sad, sad day for Hawaiians, the day that the Hawaiian flag was lowered in the palace grounds and the American flag went up. So, I don't know. Yeah, I guess I was making a few connections there, and it seemed to speak to the present. But yeah, I had other stuff to do.
You start the book by discussing all of these odd little things in Hawaii. Some of this material I didn't know. The origins of the famous Hawaiian plate lunch. I mean, the first time you were served it, did you start thinking, what is macaroni salad doing on a plate with rice?
The first time I went there, on that first trip, I took the bus up to the North Shore because it was December and I wanted to see the big waves, you know. I didn't want to go anywhere near them, but I wanted to see that. And so I had my first plate lunch. I got it from a lunch truck and ate it on the beach. And yeah, I mean, it is very curious food, the scoops of rice and the scoops of macaroni salad. But then I didn't really think much of it. It was only in researching this book and finding out about the history of the sugar plantations, because the sugar plantations that the missionary descendants founded there required so much labor that they had to import all these people from all over the world, mostly from Asia, the Chinese, Japanese, Koreans, Filipinos, Portuguese. And what would happen is that these people at lunchtime would share one another's food. And that sort of is the origins of the plate lunch, which sounds kind of happy-go-lucky, but really the reason that all of these different people who couldn't speak one another's languages were imported there was because the plantation owners intentionally created their own little towers of Babel in Hawaii, because they believed that if their workers could not speak one another's languages, if they could not communicate with each other, then they would be less likely to organize against their overlords. So even though the plate lunch seems like this kind of funny, weird, little multi-ethnic utopia, its origins are a little bit nefarious, but it does reflect, you know, the later Hawaiian culture, which is sort of this mishmash of all of these different people from all over the world.
And poi, the first time I tried poi, which is traditional, mm-hmm. it seemed to me to be kind of a purple Elmer's glue all.
It is an acquired taste, I think, and it's not a taste I've entirely acquired myself, but Hawaiians are not just obsessed with it or addicted to it. They speak about it very lovingly and often. It's more than just a staple food. It's kind of a bit of almost a religion.
The entire book, Unfamiliar Fishes, talks about the history of Hawaii from before the missionaries landed, but gets into depth on how the missionaries started to come, who were the early missionaries, in particular the Binghams and the Thurstons and their trip, and alternates between New England and Hawaii because that was the connection, and takes us all the way up to the coup d'etat that resulted in the annexation of Hawaii. Let me ask you, Sarah Val, let's go back. Okay, you know you're going to write about Hawaii. Do you have any idea of the form it was going to take at that point? I mean, how did the form of the book come about?
I think when I first started, I thought that the form, it would be a little more halvesies, like there would be much more about the annexation era. But the more I researched, the more I kind of got sucked into the world of the decade leading up to annexation and the missionaries and their children. And it also seemed like, while interesting the story of the annexation and all of those players, it is fascinating, but it's an easy story to tell. You know, there are a few guys, they bicker, like, a lot happens very fast, and boom, Hawaii is U.S. territory. So it didn't really make sense to linger on that when I had become so enamored with the Americanization that happened before annexation because of all of these Americans moving to Hawaii and having so much influence on the affairs there. And also, it probably speaks to my own fascination with the spread of the Protestant Reformation. It's what interested me about the Massachusetts Bay colonists, too, is the bookishness of these learned, churchy New Englanders. And the thing about the missionaries to Hawaii is how successful they were as educators, you know, because the thing about Protestantism is a Protestant needs to know how to read because Protestant needs to read his or her Bible, you know. And so there's a whole educational revolution inherent within Protestantism that has all these other effects. And I'm certainly part of that tradition myself. You know, I was born in Oklahoma and I spent my first 11 years in this really small kind of dusty country music town where it wasn't the most academic of places, but because it was so religious, you know, 1,000 people in 5 churches. And I had a very weirdly studious childhood, even though I could name all of the people I knew who had gone to college on, like, less than 2 hands. I had a very studious childhood just because, you know, I was in church 3 or 4 times a week and Bible study, and I was supposed to read this book every day and memorize the verses and be able to talk about it in the prayer meetings. And so reading was very central to that. You know, I was expected to read my Bible every day. And the fact that these missionaries from New England, they come there, they invent a written language for the Hawaiian language, and then they proceed to teach nearly everyone in Hawaii to read. I mean, in the middle of the 19th century, it might have had the highest literacy rate in the world. And then they brought their printing presses with them. They translated the Bible into Hawaiian. They published all of these books and newspapers and textbooks, almost all of it in the Hawaiian language. So not that I don't have respect for the oral tradition, I do. There is a very rich literature in the Hawaiian oral tradition, but as a writer, I'm guilty of privileging the written word, and from that point of view, the missionaries were wildly successful.
The missionaries came from a group that I had never heard of called the ABCFM, and it seemed that as you did more and more research, this one group kind of towered over the others in terms of bringing the missionaries over, indoctrinating them, and in a sense, setting the stage for the later years. What was the ABCFM?
It stands for, it rolls off the tongue, American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions. And the mission to the Sandwich Islands was just one of their many, many projects. It's a very influential group. I mean, they've sent missionaries all over the world. They sent missionaries into the American Indian tribes, including the Cherokee. They're basically the people who Christianized the Cherokee nation, for one. I have a friend who's of Armenian descent who just read the book, and he said, these guys were in Turkey. They're the ones who, you know, were messing with the Armenians, too. They went to Palestine and Ceylon, all over the place. The one thing I love about this story and this history is because Hawaii is so small and so isolated, there's kind of this chain of events and they're sort of a cause and effect, you know, like this one little group in Boston. They are sending people all over the world, but the ones in Hawaii, there are only about 12 boatloads come over 40 years and, you know, a few families put down roots in Hawaii and it's their children who attend a school that the missionaries established to educate their own children. It's called Punahou School. Our president is an alumnus of that school. That's where all of these children who came to be called the missionary boys, the ones who overthrew the Hawaiian Queen, the ones who founded the sugar plantations, as well as a whole economy set up that was dependent on the sugar plantations, you know, banks and lawyers, stuff like that. So the second and third generation, the children and grandsons of these original missionaries, they're the ones who completely changed the islands because, you know, the plantations changed the islands ecologically because there were these massive engineering projects to move water in the form of irrigation ditches from the mountains and the highlands into the dry, flat plains, which had been sort of desert-like before, but then were soon, you know, green with the cane blowing in the wind. And then also they changed the racial landscape just by bringing in all these other ethnicities to work for them. So that group back in Boston that, you know, sent those few boatloads of missionaries ended up having a completely disproportionate effect on Hawaiian history and culture.
There were, I think, something like 8 families. I don't remember the exact number.
Are you thinking of the big five, the conglomerates that eventually came to basically rule the economic life of the islands? And a lot of these conglomerates started as the missionary sons' sugar plantations.
About halfway through the book, when we're convinced that it's the missionaries and the Hawaiians, you bring in another element, the whalers. Had they been coming to Hawaii prior to the missionaries?
It was pretty much exactly concurrent. I think the first couple of whaling ships, both of them from New England, came to Hawaii in 1819 as the missionaries from Boston were en route, that first group of missionaries. And then the whalers started sort of coming in droves in 1820, the year that the missionaries arrived. The golden age of whaling basically is between 1820 to 60, which is pretty much the exact years of the mission to Hawaii. So they're there at the exact same time. They just have contradictory goals, you know. The missionaries, I mean, one of their big successes was converting to Christianity some very important people in the Hawaiian ruling class, including a couple of very powerful queens, and also convincing the Hawaiian government to pass laws, laws regulating liquor, laws outlawing fornication and adultery. You know, the whalers, there was no whaling in Hawaiian waters, but the islands, because they're sort of located halfway between all of the lucrative whaling grounds off South America and off Japan, and then later when Arctic whaling started, Hawaii's just kind of right there in the middle of the Pacific, the perfect place to pick up food and supplies and have some R&R and pick up replacements for all of the deserters who couldn't bear the whaling life. And so Hawaii becomes their convention center. You know, there are sailors on leave. That's who they are in Hawaii. And a sailor on leave is going to want liquor and fornication and adultery. And there's sort of this clash between the two groups of New Englanders where, you know, eventually a whaling ship off Maui, when the crew finds out they can't have prostitutes, they fire their cannon at the mission house, and there are other altercations as well. But there are just so many more whalers than there are missionaries. You know, there are only, like, I think 12 ships brought missionaries over 40 years, but there are, like, hundreds and hundreds of whaling ships stopping in Honolulu or Lahaina every year. The whalers kind of have a lot of impact on the economy of Hawaii. You know, businesses pop up, like bowling alleys to entertain them, or obviously, you know, more nefarious businesses. And then also kind of changed a little bit of the agriculture, because this is really before the sugar plantation. So Hawaiian farmers start growing a lot of food that whalers prefer. You know, they like potatoes, which wasn't really a big crop before, and they want beef. Cattle had been introduced by George Vancouver of the Royal Navy, just because he gave some cows to King Kamehameha the Great one time, but the cattle industry kind of exploded because, you know, the whalers wanted a steak at port. So these two groups of New Englanders who are kind of at extreme ends of, I guess, what we would also call these days the culture wars, you know, your churchy Jesus freaks and your sailors on leave, had kind of equal impact on the islands.
The fact that struck me that I never knew about was the bowling alley story. You know, Herman Melville hung out at a bowling alley. Mm-hmm. I mean, were you surprised to discover the bowling alley story?
I'm really uninformed about the history of bowling, so that's just one of the wonderful educational side effects. One of the things that it took me a while to figure out, though, when you just hear the kind of bullet points of this story, it sounds like the missionaries just moved in and took over. And that really wasn't the case. You know, you have a very powerful monarchy and a very powerful ruling class of aristocrats. The missionaries, a lot of their inroads into having power in the government and their children owning and controlling land had to do with the generosity of, you know, one of the Hawaiian kings, the one who commissioned a constitution, made that monarchy a constitutional monarchy with a legislature, you know, giving up some of his power. And he invited a lot of these foreigners into his government just because they were, you know, some of the most educated people around. And he also privatized the land and made it possible for foreigners to own land. So a lot of the inroads they made isn't just because the Hawaiian people are a bunch of weaklings who kowtow to white people. Part of it is because of the generosity of one Hawaiian king who, you know, lessened his own power and let loose a lot of his control over the land.
And the land wound up being owned by people who were not from the land.
It depends on your definition of that. You know, the missionary children, they were born in Hawaii. You know, many of them did not set foot in the United States till they went off to college. So they were subjects of the Hawaiian kingdom. It's just that they had been brought up and raised in this, you know, school for missionary children by these New Englanders who raised them to be New Englanders just 5,000 or 6,000 miles from New England. So it is kind of more complicated than that, because they were Hawaiian subjects.
Because of that, you get some New England-style architecture throughout.
Yeah, the sort of clapboard little houses and churches. I mean, it is kind of dislocating, because I live on the East Coast, and then I would fly all the way out there and then, you know, be on some road and turn a corner, and there's like a church straight out of Connecticut or something. The English traveler Isabella Bird, she went to Hawaii in the, I think, 1870s, and she talks about that too, how, you know, she feels like she's in Connecticut, but then how the severity of the New England architecture is kind of softened by all of the subtropical foliage that envelops, you know, everything there. On Maui, there's this little architectural park. It's very cute. It has examples of architecture from various groups who settled in the islands, in, you know, a native Hawaiian grass house, a Chinese pagoda, and a, you know, Portuguese kitchen, and there's a little Massachusetts salt box house, and you see that salt box house, and it looks just as ethnic as the pagoda. And I think because even though white people in the United States are less and less of a majority, it's still the sort of dominant culture, and when an American child pictures a house, a New England house is what they draw. But in Hawaii, you can see, like, no, that's an ethnicity, too.
Did you run across any history of pigeon at all?
Yeah. you know, what we were talking about earlier with the plantations and how all of these people who couldn't communicate with one another were brought there purposefully because then they couldn't strike against their bosses. They still, nevertheless, developed this particular Creole pidgin form of language that was part English, part Hawaiian, and some of the other languages too, kind of this big mishmash that everyone learned. So there's pidgin, but then there's also something I came to think of as Hawinglish, which is what happens in the academic writers writing about the history and culture of Hawaii, who employ so many Hawaiian words in their scholarship. It's almost impossible for, you know, a Hawaii girl like me to make heads and tails of things. I don't know if that's just a consequence of pidgin, why that is, but sometimes reading real August Hawaiian history books requires a dictionary in a way that was a little alienating for me.
Did you encounter any kind of opposition to your working on a book on Hawaii when you were there?
I didn't encounter any opposition. Sometimes I encountered reserve on the part of maybe some of the Hawaiians I talked to or interviewed. I didn't encounter any resistance. More, I think people in Hawaii are generally willing to tell their story because they're upset that their history is so little known in the continental U.S. Everyone I talked to, even if they thought they were taking a chance telling their story to me, they all did it because they want this story to be told and they want Americans to know what their country has gone through to help ours.
Well, when you were doing your research, did you come across any material that you would have liked to have put in, but you just couldn't find a way to get it into the story?
Yeah, more than anything I'd ever worked on, actually. I kind of narrowed down the topic as I went, and it became about Americanization. But when I started, I think it was a little more general than that. So I thought I would spend a lot of time talking about the era of the Hansen's disease outbreaks, which we used to call leprosy, and, you know, did a lot of research on that and went to Molokai, and I took this mule ride down to the old leper colony, which was, I'm not really a mule ride kind of person. And I mean, it wasn't kind of funny just because I'm afraid of heights and you have to take the mule down the steepest sea cliffs on earth, and that was sort of terrifying, and I'm allergic to pet dander, and I had to be on this mule all day going up and down the steepest sea cliffs on earth, so there could have perhaps been some laughs at my extent had I included that, but it didn't, it was like way off topic of the Americans and their impact on the island, so I cut that out. And another story that I never found a place for, I was speaking at a school to some history and English teachers, and I was talking about one of the kings, I think, Kauikeaouli. I think I said his name wrong. I probably said his name wrong just now. And I said, made some crack of, oh, I hate pronouncing Hawaiian words in front of Hawaiians. And a friend of mine, one of those teachers, he was driving me home after, and he said, that was so weird when you called us Hawaiians. And I was like, what do you mean? And he said, well, I don't think of myself as a Hawaiian. And I said, what are you talking about? You were born here. You live here. You went to high school here. You've been here your whole life and you're not a Hawaiian. And he said, no, I mean, I think of the Hawaiians as Hawaiians. He said it was like that for his father because his father had been a Holocaust refugee. And his father had been of Jewish descent, but I think his family had converted to Christianity like 3 generations before Hitler came to power. And so when his father was, you know, having trouble in Germany for being Jewish, even though he was a Catholic, he didn't know where he fit into that identity. And then he moved to Hawaii, this non-Jewish Jew from Germany who thought of him as a Jew. This guy moved to Hawaii. I really didn't know what to do with that story, but there's something about that, like all of the Hawaiians who have no Hawaiian heritage, ethnic heritage. I think it comes from maybe being a little respectful of Native identity or something. But it also seemed to me a little sad because, I mean, one thing I love about living in New York City is everyone there, we're all New Yorkers, you know. It doesn't matter if we are from Pakistan or Indiana or Croatia or Morocco. I mean, everyone there, like, the whole point of New York is that hardly anyone is from there, and we all live together and do our thing.
Was there a point where you stopped thinking of yourself as tourist and began thinking of yourself as frequent visitor?
No, never. I mean, I was always a fish out of water. I was always the only one there at any given gathering, the only one dressed like Lou Reed, you know. I would be there in December, January, and they would say, oh, you must be so happy to be here away from the winter. And then I wouldn't tell them, you know, I had this photo on my phone of the Flatiron Building in the snow that I longed for, you know. I don't know. I mean, I don't really care about that stuff. I'm not one of those writers who go native. You know, part of what I do is, like, look from the outside. There are things you can notice from the outside that you don't notice from the inside, and vice versa, you know. But, I mean, one of the things I became enamored of while I was doing this was, you know, the final recordings Johnny Cash made came out, and he does this version of Aloha Oe. And it's very charming. It's not authentic in any sense of the word, you know, but I sort of focused on that song as, yeah, it's not an authentic version of the most famous Hawaiian song, but it still has value. And I remember playing it for this old Hawaiian man I was talking to, and he listened to it, and he kind of raised his eyebrows at it, but then at the end he just said, good for him, you know, like, this is a good song, you people should be recording this song.
You mentioned fish, which brings up the title, Unfamiliar Fishes, which comes from a quote from a Hawaiian historian, David Mallow, who learned to read and write after the age of 30, and then he was writing books. To paraphrase, if a big wave comes in, large unfamiliar fishes will come up from the dark ocean and swallow smaller fish. What brought you to that specific title? Did it jump out at you, or did you have to go searching for it?
It jumped out at me because, you know, a lot of indigenous culture, there's this whole subcategory of literature of these warnings or these laments about, oh my God, the white people are taking over. You know, and like my favorite in the continental U.S. is the speech of Chief Seattle, the Northwest Indian chief who gave this speech directed to the white people who were kind of engulfing his territory. He marvels at them, like, he doesn't understand why they would move so far from the graves of their ancestors. And he says, you know, your dead cease to love you. So David Mallow, he's a very curious case because he certainly took advantage of a lot of what the missionaries brought. He learned to read and write at a pretty old age. He was then writing his book, Hawaiian Antiquities, within a few years of learning how to write. And he became a teacher and a minister and a very devout Christian. But as more and more white people started showing up and, you know, whalers and missionaries and just seeing his country kind of like overrun with these people, he wrote that letter to some native friends, you know, and he said, our people are small and they will devour us. I like that as a title, too, because unfamiliar fishes, taken out of context, it sounds a little bit funny. The unfamiliar fishes, the ones who came to Hawaii, all of these Americans, be they whalers or missionaries or all of the other random con men and capitalists, they're all a little bit eccentric or weird or extreme. You know, it's not like average Joe American who came to Hawaii in the 1820s. It's a Puritan killjoy, or it's like a sailor on spring break, or, you know, it's some Mormon con man. It's all of the Americans who went to Hawaii, whom the Hawaiians had to welcome there, were all of these sort of extreme figures.
That Mormon con man, that story, I don't remember the guy's name, but that was an amazing story that you stumbled on. This one guy comes in, he's doing cons all over the country, winds up in Hawaii and does a con there as well.
He was baptized as a Mormon in Salt Lake City, and he convinced Brigham Young that he should go to the Pacific to, you know, be essentially a missionary. And so he stopped in Hawaii, liked it, stayed. There had been a previous Mormon mission, and so Walter Murray Gibson was his name, and he took over the Hawaiian church in Hawaii, moved everyone out to Lanai, which is, you know, this small island in the shadow of Maui that... He didn't say this to anyone else, but he was planning on building his own Pacific empire. from this sheep meadow on Lanai, which has never even been a county seat. Like, it's still part of Maui County. I mean, he was quickly excommunicated once Salt Lake City got wind of what he was doing. He would do things like, you know, bury the Book of Mormon inside a hollow rock and tell the natives that if they touched it, they would be struck by lightning. And once he was excommunicated, he stuck around and, you know, he raised sheep for a while. And then he moved over to Oahu and started a newspaper and cozied up to the man who became the king, Kalakaua. And Kalakaua eventually made this guy as his premier. And, you know, you and I were we've talked about going to Iolani Palace, and also one of the big, you know, symbols of Hawaii is the statue of King Kamehameha across the street from the palace in Honolulu. Both of those two things were Walter Murray Gibson's doing, you know, commissioning the palace and that statue. He was eventually, you know, about to be lynched and had to, like, escape on a ship to San Francisco. But that's a kind of, like, I love the 19th century, you know? I mean, you get these kind of guys, these, like, ne'er-do-well weirdo dreamers who, you know, just have these big ideas and light out.
Sarah Val, what is 826NYC?
826NYC is a tutoring and writing center where I volunteer in Brooklyn, back home in New York. And it's part of a larger national organization that was founded in the Bay Area in San Francisco by my friend, the writer Dave Eggers, and a teacher named Nineveh Caligari. And we're now a national organization with these tutoring and writing centers all over the country in various cities. And we offer free drop-in tutoring for students between kindergarten and 12th grade. We also teach writing workshops in evenings and weekends. We have these field trips where a whole public school class will come in and they'll write a story together and we'll publish that as a book. In Brooklyn, we spend every summer offering basically summer camp filmmaking workshops. One of our focuses is the finished product. So we're not just about teaching writing. We publish student writing in anthologies and books. And then, you know, like in Brooklyn, when we spend the summer having workshops, filmmaking workshops, then at the end of the summer, the students have a screening of their films at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in their movie theater, which is where, you know, those same students go to the movies. So it's all about writing and encouraging writing, and also the idea that writing doesn't have to be drudgery, you know, and these places are very kid-friendly and whimsical. Each tutoring and writing center has a storefront, which is some sort of store. Like in Brooklyn, our storefront is the Brooklyn Superhero Supply Company. In San Francisco, they have the Pirate Supply Store, and that's how we hook a lot of students who come in and start doing their homework every day first, because they were kind of messing around in the store, you know.
Sarah Val, your acting career began, I guess, with the voice of Violet in The Incredibles, both the film and, I guess, the video game.
Don't forget Disney on Ice.
Disney on Ice?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is there going to be an Incredibles 2, or can't you say?
I mean, there's talk of it. Maybe someday. You know, my voice isn't getting any older, so I could still do it, you know.
And what about your work on a TV series called 6 Degrees? How did that come about?
Well, I've done these few little tiny jobs of what I call 3D acting. And, you know, that show was just a show that my buddy Stu was the producer of. I've had maybe three 3D acting jobs, and really it's just me going and standing somewhere and being myself, you know. I wouldn't call it acting.
Like Bored to Death?
Yeah, Bored to Death was me pretending to be a journalist interviewing Ted Danson and Oliver Platt. So it was basically me being me. So I don't have any sort of range or an ability to memorize lines. It's just kind of, I'll do it if a friend asks me to do it.
How did Bored to Death come about? And did you write your own lines or speak them?
No, I'm friends with Jonathan Ames, the author who is also the creator of Bored to Death, and he asked me to do it. No, those were all his lines. I did one part in, I think, Nicole Hall of Sinners' last movie, and I wrote some of my lines, but only because I'm so terrible at memorizing lines, she let me make up my own.
Well, you've been on Daily Show, Letterman, and Conan O'Brien for a while. Do you ever get used to being on these talk shows, or is it each time you kind of like have to go and walk out?
No, you get used to it. I've been doing it, I guess, more than a decade. It's not like I'm blasé about it. I just see it as another kind of storytelling challenge, you know? I mean, I watch those shows, and there are some people who are good at it and who don't take it seriously and just think they can show up in a pretty dress or a nice suit, and, like, that's... You're telling stories. You're talking about ideas, you know? So... I write books, and I have to sell these books, and the best place for me to sell books is on TV a lot of the time, ironically.
When you're writing these books and afterward, books like Unfamiliar Fishes and Wordy Shipmates, how do you think that changes you in terms of how you view the world, say, from a political or social sense?
I don't know if it comes from writing or just being alive right now during the apocalypse, but I probably get a little sadder every year that goes by, but I don't know if that's just particular to writers, really. I've never been drawn to stories about heroic people. My books aren't the kind of books you read to learn about some inspirational figure, you know, that no one's ever going to make a biopic from these books. But I think the one thing that's changed the more I write is that I have maybe more empathy, and I'm more interested in understanding even people who do things I disagree with. I'm much more interested in understanding why they do what they do, whereas before I think I was much more just judgmental. If someone, I found a character or a figure immoral, I would just, you know, say so and move on. And now I'm more drawn to figuring out, okay, well, that seems bad. Why would they do that? You know, like with the Hawaiian book, the missionaries are the object of so much disdain in the islands because of how eventually their offspring came to control about 90% of the land. But if you, like, dig in there and say, look, okay, well, why did these families stay and why did they turn to sugar agriculture? One big reason is the board back in Boston sent them a letter saying, we're cutting you guys off. These churches and schools need to be self-sufficient. You're no longer going to be funded for Boston. So basically these people who had made their home in Hawaii, if they wanted to stay there, they were going to have to make a living. And it happens to be a subtropical chain of islands with a 365-day growing season. They would have been morons to not think, hey, what about agriculture, you know? So even though the result is, you know, natives losing their land, which is horrifying, it becomes a little more understandable when you know, like, why they would set out to acquire all that land. And I think it makes them, if not more likable, at least it's easier to understand how what happened happened.
Sarah Vowell, have you begun thinking about your next book?
No, I don't know what that's going to be. It's kind of I have anxiety about that. Since I do write books for a living, and I don't know what the next one is going to be, you know. I mean, there will have to be one if I want to, like, eat. So, no, I don't know what it is.
You've been listening to an interview with Sarah Vowell, whose latest book about the history of Hawaii in the 19th century is titled Unfamiliar Fishes. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.